Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Nothing Will Be Different, a memoir by Tara McGowan Ross, narrated by Nicole Zanzarella. This time, everyone has the best intentions. You have cancer. Let's say you have cancer. Let's say you've swallowed a bad thing and now it's got its hands inside you. This is the essence of love and failure. Richard Sykin, you are Jeff. I thought I had mono once for an entire year. Turned out I was just really bored. Wayne Campbell, Wayne's World. Them Changes by Thundercat. August 2019, Montreal. Eve was explaining the way the Pap test works, in a lot of detail. I was loving it. I was wondering if Ben told her I was a nerd, or if she did this for everyone. Ben was my doctor. A thin, almost gremlinish man. He was not tall, but was very long. Long fingers, a long and perpetually craned neck. He had a bald spot, but also very pretty dark curls. He also had extremely large, kind eyes, and a very impressive bedside manner for a doctor. I am not a doctor hater. I admire and respect doctors. I just think that in order to get through med school, you either need to be a megalomaniac or a weird nerd, which is why visits with doctors are often so uncomfortable. Ben had never made me uncomfortable. One time, I asked him to prescribe me weed before it was legal, and he said no, and I cried. But not because he was mean, just because I admire and respect doctors, and being told no by people I admire and respect makes me embarrassed. When I'm embarrassed, I cry. So that was really not his fault. Weed was also legalized quickly thereafter. You're not my dad, Ben. I had recently asked Ben for a Pap test. He said that he thought it would be better if Eve did it. Eve was the nurse practitioner at his office, he explained. She was a woman and well-trained. While this would have made sense if I had ever indicated that I was uncomfortable in any way with a male doctor performing routine medical procedures on me, I had not. And this change of plans made me feel rejected. Why didn't Ben want to look at my cervix? I booked an appointment with Eve, feeling both the sting of the repudiation and extreme embarrassment about how affected I was by the whole thing. Were Ben and I not at that point, the cervix point? Why did I care? I made a mental note to talk to my therapist about it, while I changed the subject by showing Ben a new mole that had recently appeared on my knee. So there I was, with my skirt up around my hips, squatting off the end of the table so that Eve could scrape my cervix. Eve had drawn the navy blue curtains shut around the examination table, even though we were in a closed room, which was a classy touch. Everything in Eve's office was shades of dark blue, except for her triumphant diplomas, of which there were many. The diplomas were in big, beautiful mahogany frames. Eve's office was neater and better decorated than Ben's examination rooms. Eve's clothes were nicer than Ben's clothes. Eve was extremely helpful. Eve had an even better bedside manner than Ben. I was less impressed by her good bedside manner, probably because she was a woman and because she's a nurse. As she cranked my vagina open with a plastic speculum, I thought, judgmentally, that nurses had to have better bedside manners because they dealt more directly with patients. As she inserted a long swab into my vaginal canal and started to scrape my cervix, I decided that wasn't fair, and who was I to undervalue this person's labor? She makes less money than a doctor, after all, and was she not at least as skilled? I applauded myself silently for catching my critical rhetorical error as Eve deposited my cervical mucus onto a piece of glass. My leg started to cramp from holding myself half-suspended off an examination table. As a society, we have a problem with systematically undervaluing the work of women, I thought, I have to work on my internalized misogyny. I was genuinely proud of myself for thinking these things. I miss Ben. All done, said Eve. Oh, really? I said, pulling my skirt down and heaving my rear end back onto the table. So fast? When my underwear was back on, I asked her for a breast exam. I told her I felt myself up often, which was true, and that I had noticed a few small lumps in my left breast, and I wasn't sure what was normal to be there and what wasn't. I'd never had a breast exam before. She explained that my lack of breast exams were a normal result of my youth, and that most lumps were benign, and that she'd be happy to take a look. I took off my shirt, and she very gently, maddeningly gently, pressed into the flesh of my breasts and lymph nodes in my armpits. I wasn't sure if she'd ever examined a big person before. That's just skin and a bit of fat, girl, I wanted to say, but I didn't. She was going to have to really get in there if she was going to feel anything. I had to really get in there to feel it. I'd found it first when I was lying on my back, on my mattress, on the floor, probably watching television. I'd been working my fingertips into the plethora of tiny aches and pains all over my body. A mass of tight tissue in my left quadricep, the tension in the soft parts between my iliac crest and the pillowy expanse of my stomach. I had moved up to my head and worked down again, my fingers on my sinuses, trying to push the liquid out to somewhere. I didn't know where. My fingers making cold, shivering indentations when they found the tightness in my trapezius or the guitar string rigidity of my levator scapulae. On my chest, my hands moved the fat and breast tissue out of the way to uncover my constantly rigid pectoral muscles. That's when they found something. It was an accident. I was on my way to do something else. I only found one, at first. It was a little bit swollen, angry. Searching around more, I found another one in the corresponding armpit. Hmm, I said on the bed. I wasn't scared. There was no reason to be, yet. I made an appointment with Ben. Now, Eve was doing the same thing. But while she had an embodied understanding of my breasts and the role they play in my life, unlike Ben, I guess, fine, she was exploring with altogether too much care. She didn't want to go looking, lest she burst a blood vessel or trip a nerve. We had just met. She didn't know how I would react. I don't feel anything abnormal, she told me cheerfully. I told her that I usually couldn't either, unless I was lying down with my arm up. I adjusted my arm position and took her smaller hand in my bigger one. I guided her hand to where the lump was, under my left nipple, just off to the left side. She was very close to it, but she hadn't found it yet. I knew from her examination pattern, one press directly in before cocking her hand to one side and then the other, that she would find it soon. Pinching a little, pressing up, assessing. Nothing here, she said, but she was about to find it. I waited. Her hand touched it. Yeah, a bit of firmness, but no. Her hand moved, but the lump did not. She got a different angle, tried again, and it was still there. She stopped moving. Her fingers had traced over the lump, found its edges, its borders. The lump was sliding around under her fingers. As the lump shifted, it turned my stomach. It didn't hurt, but the whole makeup of my breast moved as it did. There was a nervous, uneasy feeling that spread down the left side of my body. She ran her fingers over it a few times, confirming. She was thorough. Okay, she said finally. Okay, yes. Emboldened by evidence, she made a perimeter sweep of the immediate area. She found more, hiding, smaller lumps, multitudinous, ones I did not find. I felt myself start to sweat, sour vinegar sweat. She had found a small colony of firm, round things. One was cherry-sized, and the others peas, like a planet and two soft moons. There are a few things here. Dread arrives as sensation in your body, and it is cold. Dread fills your stomach like a vase is filled with water. The coldness has a voice, and it's calm. It's certain. It has something to say to you from somewhere primordial, intuitive, and all-knowing. It says, something is wrong with you. Okay. She stopped moving her hand and then removed it completely. You can get dressed. Children who grow up in unstable environments are often better accustomed to chaos than they are to any kind of calm. There is a sick sort of pleasure I get from being approached with another person's serious problem. This pleasure, which is also relief, is multifaceted. First, I no longer have to focus on whatever boring thing I was previously attempting to slog through in my own life. The misery of those I love is a perfectly good excuse to slack off. Furthermore, it actually leaves me with a situation in which I can argue that to not slack off would be morally wrong. Homework, house cleaning, whatever I actually have to do at work, all that trash be damned. Somebody needs me. This is part of what I have come to understand as a savior complex. Children take things for granted. Whatever is demonstrated as normal, they will internalize as normal. This is why it actually doesn't matter if they have two moms, or a single dad, or a two-bedroom apartment, or a summer house, or whatever. If the adults in their life pass it off as normal, then it is. If the adults in their life pass off functional, communicative relationships as normal, a child will come to expect that as the norm. The same goes for martyrdom, overwork, charity, and hatred. My parents tried very hard to provide me with a happy childhood so that I would internalize being happy as normal. Unfortunately for them, they were organic human animals and made of meat. When I was 7, my mother got the news that her meat was rotting. She was in the last year of her 30s. Being in your 30s seemed old when I was a child, because it was the age that my parents were. Now that my own 30s are very close, I understand what everyone was saying at the time. Too young. A baby. Too young to die. My mother's prognosis was extremely poor from the moment her cancer was discovered. She did not die immediately. In a way, this is a kind of mercy. There is a qualitative difference, in my mind, between a death from a non-communicable, wasting disease and a sudden accidental death. It's not like my mother was perfectly healthy one second and then flattened by machinery the next. Perhaps most mercifully, her death was nobody's fault. I never had to do the work of negotiating whether I felt ready to forgive a drunk driver, a murderer, or an inattentive air traffic controller. There are some things you can do to cut the risk down. Quit smoking, wear sunscreen, do not vacation at the sites of recent nuclear meltdowns. None of these things are guaranteed. People get cancer and die. People have always gotten cancer and died. When I was living in rural Ontario and going to high school, one of my best friends was Annie, who is an oncology nurse now. She says that miraculous recoveries are a part of life in the cancer ward, but they never happen to the people whose church groups come in and pray in a circle. They don't happen to the people who seem to deserve or expect it. They happen with a kind of absurd randomness that seems orchestrated, to the homeless man who only got off heroin for the experimental chemo treatment, who has no family and very little community, who genuinely did not expect to live and has no plans and very few prospects. Miraculous recoveries happen very rarely to the people who will leave the ward miraculously cured, stare up at the sky and say, "Dude, what the fuck?" to the deaf ears of God. Cancer isn't responsible. It doesn't care how morally pure or kind or hard-working or well-supported you are. It's just a thing that happens to people, and then those people die. I begged God on my knees to get to keep my mother just a little while longer, so much and so often and so loudly and with such a fervor that if anyone was listening, somebody would have answered. I was a good little girl, and I deserved to get the few things I asked for. What I got instead was the understanding that God does not listen to little girls. Children normalize what is demonstrated as normal. I had a child's naive hope that my mother would pull through the entire time, and in this way I understood the situation to be serious, and in this way I got to brace for her death, which is a kind of mercy. My father did a good job of making it clear that her survival was a very slim possibility. I held out hope anyway. This remains my superpower. Calculating the worst-case scenarios, accepting them, hoping for the best in spite of it all. Natalie Wynne, YouTube philosopher, highlights a cognitive distortion she calls masochistic epistemology. Whatever hurts the most is true. It is a common affliction among the pseudo-intellectual. The assumption that the outcome that hurts your feelings the most must be the right one, not because of overwhelmingly convincing evidence in its favor or lack of evidence against it, but simply because it hurts your feelings. The worst-case scenario is usually less likely than the whole range of other scenarios that are not as bad. That's just math. As I left Eve's office, the forms for diagnostic imaging in my sweaty and shaky hands, I made a pretty profound realization. I'm good in a crisis, but I guess I'm only really good in the crises of others. In this one, not yet even confirmed crisis, requiring more evidence, not really worth panicking over if you think about it, I was going to lose my fucking shit. I reacted in a more collected way to the news my mother was dead than I did to the news that I had a very common breast abnormality that, in combination with my family history, made diagnostic imaging a good idea. I do not know if that means I was more emotionally mature at 27 than I was when I was 9, or less so. I had 2.5 years to brace for my mother's death, which was a mercy. When I met my current boyfriend, Sandy, he was still grieving. His friend Rosemary had died suddenly a few years earlier from a brain aneurysm. Nobody's fault. Nothing anyone could have done. She didn't hit her head. She didn't have any symptoms before. It was just one of those Judas body, random malfunction things. She was 27. I never met Rosemary, but I think about her all the time. My mother died, and it was very sad, and it changed me forever. But was it a tragedy, necessarily? The way a Greek tale of hubris or betrayal is a tragedy? Is Rosemary's death a tragedy, or was it just horrible? Is there a lesson to be learned? Any kind of takeaway other than some platitude about the fundamental impermanence and ultimate fragility of life on Earth? Usually, when I think about Rosemary, the only conclusion that I reach is that a brain aneurysm is a crazy, scary, stupid way to die. I walked to the bus stop from Eve's office with panic brewing in my stomach in a way it never had before. Like a headache. Like a fever. I was sweating, looking for the bus. The humid early autumn in Côte Saint-Luc made me perspire and then go immediately cold. People had lots of different reactions when we told them Mom was gone. Shocked silence, sputtering out questions, sudden tears, in a few cases, screaming. My dad took me out into the sunshine to tell me my mom was dead. The way you take a dog to the soft grass behind the shed to shoot it. I just crossed my hands in my lap and nodded. The feeling in my stomach was of something suddenly emptying out. A hole being ripped in the side of a spaceship. Matter screaming out into the void. The hole inside me was cold and shiny and throbbed for attention. I have been trying to fill it ever since. The concrete in Côte Saint-Luc was paler than it is in the rest of the city, especially in the high light of the middle of the day. I never wore sunglasses because I was always breaking or losing them. I squinted toward the bus stop, suddenly unable to differentiate spaces particularly well. I walked toward it in a daze. The buses came regularly in Côte Saint-Luc, but no one ever took them. When my dad told me that the first home I had ever known was gone, I just nodded. Children take things for granted. If you present things as normal, they will be accepted as normal. On the bus, there were a few middle-aged women and one Hasidic man holding a Nikon flip phone to his ear under the brim of his beautiful hat. The rest of the bus was empty and quiet. The women had gone pillowy and lovely with age, their faces lined from smiling. I wanted to be an aging auntie on the bus one day. I wanted to overhear more Yiddish phone conversations. I wanted to go on delighting in the contours of languages I loved but did not understand. Some people just get cancer and then they die. Children take things for granted. I am not a child anymore. I want to live. The King of Carrot Flowers, Part 1, by Neutral Milk Hotel. May to October 2011, Halifax. The story I want to tell you starts after my first year at Dalhousie University. I guess I have to back up a little. Bear with me. I had just auditioned for the school's acting program, a program that only accepted second-year students. I'd tanked my first audition, hard. While I delivered a good performance of my modern dramatic monologue, the George and Martha sad, sad, sad speech from Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, complete with mid-Atlantic accent and fake tears, I had forgotten half my Shakespeare monologue and burst into uncontrollable and very real tears. I had opted to sing one of my friend's band's punk tunes in lieu of learning an actual musical theater song for the audition, something I thought was very rock and roll at the time. My gatekeepers were not impressed, but I'd gotten a callback audition anyway. I sighed with relief when I saw my name on the list. Of course, why was I so worried? I always pulled it off in the end. I'd been saving for university since I got my 14th birthday present, a job at the only cafe in Kennington, Ontario, the tiny farming village where I had spent the majority of my childhood and teen years. I'd spent all of it on one single year of tuition and books at Dalhousie, my dad and stepmother still having to spot me for some of it, and also allowing me to live at home and eat their food. This economy, you know. I had adjusted shakily to the demands of a schooling system where I couldn't pull everything off at the last minute, and had finished the year with my confidence damaged. Dalhousie was raising tuition again the next year, and while we had demonstrated in March of 2011, inspired by the leadership of student organizers at universities in Quebec, it looked like the powers that be were going to go ahead with the hike anyway. My dad, my stepmom, and I were renters in our house on Compton Avenue. Most of the money my dad made went right back into his business. "We'll figure it out," he told me. I wasn't sure how. On my 19th birthday, I moved out of my parents' place and into an apartment with my boyfriend of 1 year. My boyfriend was a banjo-playing bike mechanic, almost half a foot shorter than me. He had strong, squared hands and a huge smile. He was kind and innocent and sweet, Or at least seemed that way. He also lied to me, all the time, but only to make me happy. He had a classic monosyllabic name, something like Al or Rick or Tim. Let's call him Tim. Tim and I took one of the four bedrooms in our summer sublet, the rest of which were occupied by various members of our friend circle, including Matilda, one of my two best friends. After my parents moved us from Cannington to Halifax the summer before grade 12, I had to expand the definition of best friend to suit the members of my new life. It had seemed wrong at first. Surely my best friends were exclusively the friends I had back in the southern Ontario farming communities I hadn't wanted to leave. I had to admit, though, that the base level of fucked up that had been established by my mother's death in 2001 had been pushed to some unmanageable levels by my brother's overdose and my sister moving out. I had understood the urge to bail, to head for a coast, to start over, but I had still resisted the move, like teenagers do. My only real friend was our family's miniature poodle, Pip, until I found Matilda and Kate, and Tim. That was when my world opened up, for the first time ever, really. Tim and I were sharing a bedroom. 2 weeks after we moved in, I spiked up my mohawk, put on something skanky, and got a bloody nose at a hardcore show. The next morning, which was actually afternoon, I woke up hungover and tried to get Tim to fuck me, which didn't work. "Your necklace is gone," Tim said quietly. He was speaking so quietly these days. He always seemed so sad all the time. I put my hand to my throat. Tim had welded together four links of bike chain and threaded it through a ribbon for me as a gift. Looking back, it was probably an ugly necklace, but I never took it off, even to shower. My neck was bare for the first time since he had tied the choker around my throat, like a collar, like a promise. It must have gotten knocked off at the show. Tim turned away from me in bed. I was annoyed. Why was he like this? "Tim," I asked, then half joking, "do you love me?" "Yes," he said, and I could hear he was crying. "What's wrong?" I was as annoyed as I was concerned. He didn't answer. I called his bluff. "What is it? What, do you hate me? Do you not want to be with me anymore?" It was a joke. I asked this all the time. All the time he replied, "Of course not. Don't even say that. I love you forever. I'm going to marry you." Setting the stakes this high would usually shock him into telling me whatever was going on. "I do," he said this time, still turned away, still with tears I could hear in his mouth and his eyes. I smiled. Then, "but I don't think I can anymore." I felt my smile physically dump out of the bottom of my face. "Wait, what?"
"Tara! Hi, Tara!"
echoed the chorus of girl voices at work. The staff from the morning was still there, and my colleague for the afternoon shift was early. I stomped down the concrete steps in my combat boots. When I wasn't hanging out with Tim or Matilda or Kate, I worked full-time as a barista at Uncommon Grounds Coffee House. It was in the basement of a condo complex. The look was industrial chic and brightly branded, with very low red leather seating and huge red coffee cups stamped on the floors and the tables, rows of expensive neon French presses, and locally made candies lining the walls. I hadn't cried yet. Mostly I had argued with Tim, as if his disinterest in continuing our relationship was some kind of intellectual misunderstanding that I could correct. My cafe job, which Matilda had gotten me 4 months before, was amazing. Very little was expected of me. I had access to a treasure trove of free food, and I was very willing to be friendly to strangers as long as I had enough caffeine. something that made me a mostly good employee, despite being lazy by nature. I worked primarily afternoon shifts, which were slow, and went from 2:30 in the afternoon until 10:30 at night.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?